rejection. We've all experienced it. We all know the pain of it. Perhaps when you were a little kid, you asked another little kid to be your friend, but they wanted to be someone else's friend, and so you got rejected. Maybe in high school, you tried out for a sports team, tried out for a club that you wanted to be a part of, and you didn't make the cut, and you were rejected. You all were accepted to UCLA, but maybe you received a rejection from another school. In basketball, one of the worst feelings is getting your shot rejected. But it doesn't even compare to the pain of when a guy asks a girl out, sticks his neck out there, puts his very heart on the table, only to be rejected. And so we've all felt the pain of rejection. And tonight's passage is about rejection, but an even greater rejection, an infinitely greater rejection. Because this is a rejection of God Himself. And the consequences of this rejection are far worse. They echo into eternity. So as you turn your Bibles to Romans chapter 1, we're going to be studying verses 18 to 23. And as I read this passage, listen for the rejection. Listen for the cosmic rejection. The rejection of God Himself. Romans chapter 1, let's back it up to verse 16 to capture Paul's flow of thought. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Guys, let me just give you a big fat warning up front. In our study of the book of Romans, we are entering a tunnel, a very dark and very long tunnel that we're not going to get out of until chapter 3, verse 21. And so for us, we're not going to get out of this dark tunnel until late winter quarter. And if you think the passage that we just read is dark, you have even more darkness in store for you. This passage just gets darker and darker and darker. And just when you think it can't get any more dark, it gets the darkest right at the end of this tunnel. Chapter 3, verses 9 to 20. Where you just get barraged with multiple arguments pinning you against the wall to convince you that there is none righteous, not even one. And that's the point of Paul bringing us into this tunnel, to show that all people are under sin without exception, and thus all people are under the wrath of God without exception. Now, as we take a step back, let's ask ourselves this question. Why do we have to talk about this? Why do we have to talk about darkness? Why do we have to go into the tunnel? Why do we have to talk about the sinfulness of men and how people reject God? Why can't we keep it positive, upbeat, and happy? Why can't I come up here and just share some of those restore your faith in humanity stories? You know, some of those heartwarming stories. Well, it's because to pretend like everything is great, to pretend like everything is just sunshine and rainbows, to pretend like people's hearts are not poisoned with sin, may make you happy for a while, but eventually it'll make you feel disappointed, disillusioned. You're going to be jaded. And ultimately, this leads to eternal condemnation. Whereas embracing the truth about man's sin and man's depravity leads to the ultimate good, the ultimate joy, and experiencing the greatest love found in Jesus Christ. A doctor does his patient no service and no favor when that patient is diagnosed with terminal cancer. And the doctor goes up to the patient and says, "You're fine. Just go home and get some rest. You'll feel fine." No, the doctor does that patient service. That doctor is helpful to that patient when he delivers the bad news and says, "You are sick. You have cancer. You're going to die. But there's a cure. And you need to get started on this treatment right away, and then you will be healed." And that's what Paul is doing for us in this dark, dark passage. He shows us that we are terminal, spiritually terminal, so that it gives us the urgency to seek out the cure found in Jesus. So let's take a look at this passage. Last time we looked at the thesis statement of Romans, the big picture passage, Romans in a nutshell, which was verses 16 to 17. And I told you to look out for that little word "for," because it's the golden link that gives you the logical flow to verses 16 and 17. It further explains, it elaborates, it builds off of what was just said. Verse 15, why is Paul so eager to preach the gospel? For, or because, he's not ashamed of the gospel. Why are you not ashamed of the gospel, Paul? For it is the power of God to save everyone. How is the gospel the power of God to save everyone? Because in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith. That is, if you have faith in Jesus Christ, you will be righteous before God, as it is written all the way back in the Old Testament, "The righteous shall live by faith." And as you may have noticed in our passage today, verses 18 to 23, Paul continues to pile on the fours. Verses 18, 19, 20, and 21 all begin with the word "for." This is all linked. This is a logical progression. Each verse builds off of the previous one. And so just to lay this all out, big picture, I have a slide for you, just to capture Paul's logical flow in our passage. So verse 18 is the topic sentence. That summarizes the rest of chapter 1. And it is that God reveals his wrath toward those who suppress the truth with their unrighteousness. Then Paul begins to unpack this. How does it work? God reveals himself to his people, those who he has created. How does he reveal himself? Through nature. People are able to know God through nature. Therefore, people are without excuse for not honoring God. But people did not honor God and instead honored idols. So that gives you the logical progression of this passage today. Let's first look at verse 18, and then we'll look at these five steps of rejecting God. What's the topic sentence? What's the second half of chapter 1 all about God's wrath revealed because of man's unrighteousness. Or to say it plainly, people are very bad. And therefore, God is very mad. Now, like I said, the word "for" ties this in with the theme passage, verses 16 to 17. Also notice the word "revealed" appears in both verse 17 and verse 18. So there's a contrasting revealing of God. Why do we need God's righteousness to be revealed? Because God's wrath is also revealed. We need God's righteousness because we are unrighteous. And those who are unrighteous will incur the wrath of God. Well, what is God so mad about? Verse 18, his wrath is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. His anger is against sin. He's mad at sin. He hates sin. So we learn that this anger is really a natural expression of his holiness. It's his refusal to condone sin. It's his refusal to even be neutral towards sin or to sweep sin under the rug. His holiness cannot tolerate evil, and so this sin, this ungodliness and unrighteousness sets his heart on fire because he hates it. Habakkuk 1:13, your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. As we keep reading in verse 18, we see that it is this sin, this unrighteousness that people use to suppress the truth. You could think of suppressing the truth like an overstuffed suitcase. You're on vacation, and it's time to go home. You brought too much clothes with you. You bought too many souvenirs and gifts for people. And you're trying to stuff it all into the suitcase, but it just won't close. And so, what do? The oldest trick in the vacationing book. You sit on your suitcase. You put all your weight on the suitcase. And as best you can, you close it up just enough so you can zip it up really quick. Well, that's the picture here with this word suppressed. People take truth about God, and they stuff it into a suitcase and sit on it. Say, God? What God? I don't see any God around here. That's what it means to suppress the truth. But notice this suppressing of the truth isn't simply a cognitive exercise. It's not just a heady thing. It's not just that you sit around in an armchair and reason away God and rationalize why God can't exist, and if any thought about God enters your head, you just quickly push it out. No, this is not just an intellectual exercise. Read verse 18 again. Who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth? The act of sinning, doing deeds of unrighteousness, is what keeps the truth pressed down and out of sight. It's a whole lifestyle of sin that works against the truth. You see, this is how it works. When you love sin, you can't love the truth, because the truth threatens your pleasures. The truth tells you that there is a God, that he does exist, that he did create you, that you are accountable to him, and you have to live for him and not yourself, and you have to forsake all of the pleasures of your sin. That truth is threatening to the sinner. That truth is dangerous to the sinner because it threatens your pleasures. So your heart says, if I want to keep sinning, I got to get rid of this truth. You got to choose. It's truth or sin. And in our natural state as sinners, we choose the sin. We got to do something with the truth. We stuff it in the suitcase, sit down on it. Truth? I don't see any truth. Now I can go on with my sin. You see this in John 3:19. Let me read it for you. Jesus said, and this is the judgment. The light, that is the truth. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. Why do they love the darkness? Why do they want to stay ignorant? Because their works were evil. That is, they were unrighteous. Light and truth would expose their sin, but darkness conceals it. Therefore, they want to stay in the darkness. They want to stay in a dark corner of the room with their back to the light and pretend like it's not there, because that protects their sin. If there is a God, then I got to live for him. But if I could take what I know about God and stuff it away, then I can continue to live the way I want to live. So we see that with unbelievers, the problem isn't ignorance, first and foremost. The problem is a heart that loves unrighteousness. The problem isn't primarily an intellectual one, but it is primarily a moral one. It's a heart issue before it is a head issue. To protect their sin, unbelievers, even though they know the truth, stuff it down, zip it up, lock it away, so they don't have to face it. And that begs one question that I thought of. Are atheists liars? You have an atheist friend, and they say, I don't believe in God. And you say, oh, come on, you little liar. I've read Romans 1. I know you believe that God exists. I know you believe in the truth. You're just suppressing it so you could live your sinful life. But I know you believe in God. All atheists are liars. It's not exactly the approach I would take with that. I wouldn't go around calling your atheist friends liars, because simply, they may not know that they are suppressing the truth. Yes, the truth is in them, but as this passage says, it is suppressed. It is distorted. It's tucked away deep into their hearts. On top of that, look at verse 21. They have a foolish heart. Now, foolish doesn't mean that they're stupid. Foolish means that they're unable to reason rightly about God. And on top of that, that foolish heart is darkened. And on top of that, you take into consideration Jeremiah 17:9, which reads, the heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. Who can understand it? Our hearts are so deceitful, so complex, so sick that we can't even fully understand our own heart. So to call our atheist friends liars, I don't think is appropriate, because they may be suppressing the truth and they don't even know it. Some may be aware that they're doing it. If you caught them on a day when they felt very open and very vulnerable, they may say something like, yeah, I just don't want to think about God, because if he exists, then I got to live a completely different life. But many atheists, and maybe most of them, don't understand what they're doing. The truth of God is in them, but it is darkened. It is tucked away. It's buried deep down. But what verse 18 tells us is that the truth is in there somewhere. It's in their hearts. And this should be a big encouragement for us in evangelism. The truth is in there. It's in there somewhere. It's in the heart of every person you fish to this week. They've buried that truth with their sin, but what's encouraging is that when you share the gospel with non-Christians, you're not starting from scratch. You're not starting with a blank slate. You're talking to someone that has a bent, even if it's an ever so slight bent. Even if this bent toward the truth is twisted, distorted, suppressed down for years and years, in there somewhere is the thought, maybe there is a God. Maybe there is one who created all of this. Maybe there is one who created me. And that's what we see in the next verse. We finish looking at this topic sentence. God is angry against people who live lifestyles of unrighteousness, which suppress the truth about him. And this is ultimately a rejection of him. Now let's see how Paul breaks this down. Let's look at these five steps explaining how someone rejects God. Step one, God revealed himself to people. Verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. God took initiative. God proactively revealed himself to mankind. He wasn't playing hide and seek, forcing us to search for him. He says, no, people know me because I made myself known to them. Notice the emphasis on man's ability to know God in this passage. Verse 19, what can be known about God is plain. And then even stronger, God has shown it to them. Verse 20, have been clearly perceived. Verse 21, they knew God. So God purposefully revealed truth about himself. How? Through nature, which is what we see in our second step. Step two, people are able to know God through nature. It's found in the first part of verse 20. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. There is truth about God revealed in the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. When you go on a hike and see the beauty of nature, when you sit at the edge of the Grand Canyon and are just blown away by the immensity of it. When you get away from the city and sit under a night sky full of stars. When you sit in your lectures and when you read your textbooks and you learn about the world and how the world works, you see evidence of God. On every rock, every tree, every beating heart, every animal, every raindrop from the largest planet all the way down to the smallest subatomic particle, you see the fingerprints of a creator. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. You could think of the classic watchmaker analogy, and I think it's a helpful one. If you're walking in the woods and you come across a watch on the ground, you're not going to say, looks like that watch just came to be. No, you're going to assume that someone made this watch, that there is a watchmaker. And no one would believe that random chance and random force would put together this watch. All the parts, the multiple wheels, the cogs, the screws, the springs, the battery, the two hands, the numbers, that all work together to keep time. And so if a watch must have a watchmaker, then a universe that is so much more complex, with so many more parts and performs so much more impressive functions, that kind of universe must have a universe maker. But it gets more specific than that. Look at verse 20 again. In nature, you not only see the evidence of the existence of a creator, you get two specific attributes of this creator, his eternal power and divine nature. Eternal power. You see power in nature. There must be someone great, mighty, powerful, who made all of this. And this being's power must be eternal, because this being must have exerted this power before the creation. The one who made the mountains and the seas and sky must have existed before the mountains and seas and sky. This is his eternal power. And the second truth creation reveals about God is his divine nature. Whoever this creator is, he is no man. He is a cut above man. He is divine. Now, I want to draw your attention to that little phrase at the end of verse 20, the things that have been made. That verb, have been made, is interesting in the Greek. The Greek word for have been made is pronounced poiema. Poiema. It means to create, construct, or compose. Poiema. And that is the Greek word from which we get the English word poem. A poem is a genre of literature that requires great care, purpose, and rational thought to wordsmith it, to give it cadence and pattern and beauty. And this idea of a poem gives a great illustration for verse 20. Let's say that you're walking on the beach, and in the sand, you see the letter L. Well, you would probably say, well, probably just the wind. The wind did that. But if you were walking on the beach and saw in the sand an entire poem, well, nobody would say, oh, it's just the wind. There must be a poet who did this. And that's creation. That's what has been made. It's one big poem. What has been made has design, purpose, intelligent intentionality. And everybody sees it. Everybody reads the poem of creation, but many suppress it. So far, unless you've been asleep up to this point, you can tell that I'm not exactly agreeing with evolution. This isn't exactly the kind of stuff that you learn in your classes here at UCLA. In our educational system and in our textbooks, naturalistic evolution is a given. It is taught as this is the way it is. But there are some scientists who read the poem of God's creation and see the poet. Now, let me give you one example. Michael Behe is a biochemist who wrote about a concept that he called irreducible complexity, and he applied it to the human cell. He talks about what it takes for a cell to be a cell, and what it takes for it to perform what it performs. Evolution teaches that things like the cell evolve through a series of small modifications over time. But Behe argues that this can't be the case because the human cell is irreducibly complex. There are so many parts of a cell that interrelate in so many complex ways that if just one of the little parts of a cell was missing, the whole thing shuts down. So it couldn't have emerged incrementally, as evolution suggests, because the cell just wouldn't work without one of those parts. Take out the nucleus, take out the ribosomes, take out the cytoplasm, take out the mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. Take any of those things out, and the cell doesn't work. Better to take that all of these little parts of a cell were created at one time rather than incrementally, as evolution would suggest. And one of Behe's most interesting examples is that of the bacterial flagellum. And I remember the funny flagellum from biology class. It's the little bacteria with the little tail that makes it move. And this is what he says. The flagellum is a whip-like rotary motor that enables a bacterium to navigate through its environment. The flagellum includes an acid-powered rotary engine, a stator, O-rings, bushings, and a drive shaft. The intricate machinery of this molecular motor requires approximately 50 proteins. Yet, the absence of any one of these proteins results in the complete loss of motor function. The irreducible complexity of such a biochemical system cannot be explained by the Darwinian mechanism, nor indeed by any naturalistic evolutionary mechanism proposed to date. So that is Michael Behe. That is an intelligent design guy. But let me bring you some quotes from evolutionists. I find it so fascinating that even evolutionists admit that nature looks like it's been designed. Of course, they don't admit that there is a designer, but I found some interesting quotes from them. Richard Lewontin, an evolutionary biologist from Harvard, said, quote, "Living organisms appear to be carefully and artfully designed," end quote. A more famous evolutionist, also named Richard Dawkins, said in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, quote, "Biology is the study of complex things that appear to be designed for a purpose," end quote. Of course, he denies that they actually have been designed for a purpose, but he admits that the appearance is that this has all been designed for a purpose. And then Francis Crick, molecular biologist, most famous for being the co-discoverer of DNA, said, quote, "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see has not been designed, but has evolved," end quote. Is that not a suppression of the truth? Is that not Romans 1? That's a rejection of God. These highly intelligent and gifted men read the signature of God off of DNA, off of the cell, off of the complexity and beauty of the human body. And they say, this can't be a poem. Because if it is, then there's a poet. Then there's a creator. And I got to live for him and not for myself. And I have to put away all my unrighteousness. But God has indeed made it plain. It's plain. It's obvious that he made all of this. Therefore, step 3, people are without excuse for not honoring God. End of verse 20. So, therefore, in conclusion up to this point, so they are without excuse. Since people can know something of God through nature, they are accountable for acknowledging him as God. And as we'll see in the next verse, they should honor him and they should give him thanks. And if they don't honor him, that's on them because of steps 1 and 2. And this brings up a couple of questions. Can people be saved through natural revelation? That is the revelation of God through nature, through creation. Because it sounds like it. The answer is no. That's not Paul's argument here. Paul's not saying that you can look out into creation, that you can be in a forest and look at a beautiful tree and say, ah, Jesus died for my sins, and I need to place my faith in Jesus. That's not Paul's argument here. He doesn't intend to say that creation brings people to a saving knowledge of God. But what he intends to say is that seeing creation brings them to a more basic knowledge of God, namely his eternal power and divine nature. And he's underscoring the wickedness of men who take even this basic knowledge of God and suppress it. So to be clear, natural revelation is not enough to save. People must hear and believe the gospel of Jesus Christ to be saved. So I got another question for you. What about the proverbial African tribesman who's never heard the gospel? Can't be fair to send him to hell Doesn't he have an excuse? Will God really condemn the innocent African tribesmen? No. Because there are no innocent African tribesmen. God will condemn him for his sin. All people everywhere are sinners. And ultimately, God punishes people for their sin. That tribesman has still done things to hurt other people. He still has lust and pride in his heart. Whether they hear the gospel or not, people will be judged for their sin. So you see, ultimately, people are not judged for the absence of their faith or the absence of their response to the gospel, but they're judged for the presence of their sin, the active presence of their rebellion. Is it fair that the guilty go free? No. And that's why all people everywhere, which is the argument of this dark tunnel section, are sinners and thus under the wrath of God. And so what does that mean for us? Man, if you can read that and not want to evangelize, you're not reading it right. The application of this text is evangelism and missions. This text should put the fire under your seats to go out and tell the gospel to people so that they have a chance to be saved, so that they hear the good news, that they can be forgiven of their sins. That's why we're going to hear from Jim Ayers later. That's why Jim and Bethany are in Africa and are going to spend the rest of their lives in Africa. That's why our church supports over 100 missionary families so that they can bring the gospel and spread it as much as they can so as many people as possible have the chance to be saved. And so what this means for us is that we support missions in every way that we can. It means that in our personal evangelism, hey, fishing week didn't end this week. Now that fishing week is over, sit back, relax. No, it means the work continues on until all men have heard. The work continues on. So, people are without excuse for not honoring God. Therefore, they should honor him. But, step four, they didn't. Verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Here is the rejection of God described in a variety of ways. They did not honor God. They did not worship the powerful and divine one. They did not give thanks to their creator for creating them and sustaining them, didn't thank God for the air that they breathe, the food that they eat, their friends and family, sports and recreation, and all his good gifts. Guys, next week is Thanksgiving. And here we get a powerful reminder of why, as Christians, we are so thankful and why we celebrate Thanksgiving. Because we see that the mark of a non-Christian is thanklessness. Because they look at all the good gifts that they have, all the good things going on in their life, and they don't know where it came from. It just happens to be here on earth, so I enjoy it. And so they have no one to thank. But we as Christians know that all these good gifts come from above, come from our Father. And so we thank him. And that's why this holiday is sweet to us. The rejection of God is seen from another angle when Paul says they became futile in their thinking. Empty thinking, vain thinking, vanity of vanities. All is vanity, Ecclesiastes reminds us, unless you fear God and keep his commandments. A life without God is empty. It's vain. It's futile. It's useless. And Paul also says their foolish hearts were darkened. Again, foolish doesn't mean stupid. It means that you're unable to think correctly about God. Psalm 14, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. You're backwards. You're mixed up. You're in the dark about God. The lights have turned off. And it is a blackout in your heart when it comes to thinking about God. So people did not honor God. They rejected him. And then, step five, honored and embraced idols instead. Verse 22, Paul, claiming to be wise, they became fools. In many senses, non-Christians can be and are very smart. Some of the smartest people in California are your professors, TAs, and even fellow students who walk on Bruin Walk every day. They are advancing technology, researching diseases and cures and medicine, helping us live longer and healthier, building magnificent structures. And so in many senses, they are smart. But when it comes to the most important things, the things that really matter, who is God? And how can I be right with him? They're fools. Because, verse 23, they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. They saw the glory of the immortal God. And then on the other hand, they saw the glory of mortal beings. Man and animals. And they said, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and worship the mortal beings. I'm going to take the mortal beings. And what could be more foolish than that? To trade the immortal God for images of mortal men. And that's what we've seen throughout the history of the world and even happening all throughout the world today, people taking images of people and of animals and of creeping things, that is reptiles, these graven images and statues, and they bow down to it. What could be more backwards? What could be more mixed up? What could be more in the dark than to trade the creator for the creation? What's your idol? What have you exchanged God for? Your studies? Your phone? Sex? Your social lives? Entertainment? Instead of giving praise to God for these things, you become fixated on them and worship them and look to them to satisfy you. But ultimately, the creature that we bow down to the most, ultimately the creature that we seek the greatest pleasure in, is ourselves. We bow down to ourselves. We fail to honor and glorify and please God because we want to honor, glorify, and please ourselves. So that's how you reject God in five steps. God reveals himself to you, therefore you're able to know him, therefore you're without excuse for not honoring him, but you don't honor him. And instead, you honor idols, the chief idol being yourself. So, this passage is dark. We're in the tunnel, guys. And there's definitely a part of me that wishes to get out of the tunnel right now. Just skip all of this, chapter 2, get into chapter 3, 21, where righteousness is manifest apart from the law. But we're here. And as we're here, as we're in the dark tunnel of Romans, guys, I don't want you to forget about the one who called himself the light of the world. No matter how unrighteous you are, there is a righteous one. There is one who lived a life of perfect righteousness, perfectly obeying God's law, and he did it for you. And then he hung and died on a cross for you, so that you guys could switch places, so that you could have his righteousness, and he would take your sin and be punished on the wooden cross for it. The wrath of God is revealed. But there is one who is a wrath absorber. His name is Jesus. And he will absorb God's wrath that's meant for you. He will take it, every last drop of it, if you will believe in him. Come to him. Escape the wrath. If Romans 1, 18 to 23 is you, it doesn't have to be. Don't wait for us to go further down the tunnel. If you already know that you are a rejecter of God, then stop rejecting him and come to him for grace in his son. Come to him. Come home to him. If even at this point you realize that you're terminal, that you're spiritually terminal, that your heart is sick with sin, then come now, come to the doctor who has the cure, and that is only our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.